Good morning.
Good
I'm
morning.
Lynn Ware Peek here with.
And I'm Tim Henney. Today in the program, we talk about how the well-placed swear word is not only healthy, it can possibly make you smarter. Lynn, are you feeling any smarter?
I had to just throw that in there.
We speak with Emma Byrne about her colorful bit of neuroscience that she's made into a book. It's called Swearing is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language.
And then we're joined by local professional skier Alex Schlope. Schlope has a story that you won't want to miss. Amazing success, followed by despair, depression, addiction, and now a comeback. And not only is he embracing the struggle, but he's going public with it so he can help others who may be experiencing some of the same. His new organization is called Rematch, and Alex Schlope will join us to talk about all of this in the second half of the hour. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
This is Brenda with Republic Services, your local provider for recycling and garbage collection. Information about what is acceptable to put in your curbside recycling bin can be found at summitcountyrecycles.org. Please help Summit County be clean. Remember to recycle.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peek, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Our first guest this morning, Emma Byrne, presents what she calls an irreverent and impeccably researched defense of our dirtiest words. You may be relieved to learn that cursing can be good for you. That's right. Whipping out a carefully placed swear word or two or three has been shown to reduce physical pain, to lower anxiety, to prevent physical violence, to help trauma victims recover language, and to promote human cooperation. How about that? We're pleased to welcome Emma, who joins us from London. She has written on science, language, and society for the BBC, Science, the Financial Times, and Forbes. She learned about the effectiveness of cursing when at age 9, she called her brother we can't say it on air. Emma Byrne, welcome.
Hello, Lynn.
Great to have you here. So, I mean, I guess the first obvious question is, whatever possessed you to do all of this neuroscience research and conjure up this book?
Well, my background's actually in artificial intelligence, so people are usually pretty surprised when they find out that I've branched out into this somewhat sort of more interesting but slightly obscurely researched subject. But I was based out of a neuroscience lab in London in the Science Museum. And we have these fantastic evenings where once a month we close the museum to the kids and let in a load of adults and open up a bar. And we have to find some experiments to do with those adults. And we found that fantastic, I came across that fantastic experiment that's mentioned in the book, where if you plunge your hand in ice cold water, it's definitively shown that you can keep your hand there about half as long again, as long as you're swearing, you know, compared to using a neutral word. And that's a fantastic experiment to do with members of the public. So it only takes, you know, a bucket of ice water and a stopwatch, but also that people are always really pleased to have an excuse to whip out the odd swear word. And it kind of took off from there, because I wanted to understand the paradox between the fact that swearing is so useful, it's so great at painkilling and measurably so, and yet we try so hard to avoid it as a society.
That's so great. I just have to start this off by saying I briefly dated someone in my mid-20s who told me that he thought cursing was common and trite, and that if you're actually intelligent enough, you can come up with more intellectual words to replace your curse words. And I'm so relieved to hear that that's not actually the case. So thank you, Emma.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Your ex is laboring under a very common misapprehension that swearing is a sign of a limited vocabulary. But actually, all the studies show that the size of your swearing repertoire and the flexibility with which you use it is actually positively correlated with how well you use language in general. So people who are creative with language and have a fun and wide vocabulary are most adept at using a swear word when it's absolutely the most used for a particular moment. And the thing is that swearing occupies such a different part of our brains and has such a different effect on our body from other parts of the language that you can't simply substitute another word with the same sort of meaning. If I say excrement instead of the four-letter word, it doesn't have the same effect on me biologically. So it doesn't matter how highfalutin I decide to make my language. If I really need a swear word, then only a swear word will do.
And Emma, why is that? Because, I mean, that kind of gets to the core of swearing, doesn't it? My experience has always been I felt like it was useful. I didn't know why. It kind of felt good. I didn't know why. I was shamed away from using swear words, and we make them taboo. But if they're not taboo, if we were to eliminate the taboo aspect, they would lose their potency and they wouldn't have this neurological effect.
That's absolutely right, Tim. I mean, we know from studies, for example, of trying to replicate the pain study, but using what they call minsto, so fudge or sugar, instead of the four-letter words, you just don't have any pain-killing effect. Or if you hear swear words that you've learned later on in life, for example, in a second language, they don't have the same physical potency. They don't make your heart rate rise as much. They don't release as much adrenaline as the swear words that you learned when you were much younger.
But is that a social construct? Is that something that society has created?
That's absolutely right. And the society that you grow up in, so not just the country, but also the local language and dialects, the values of the people around you, they all shape what you consider to be an offensive term. And you can see that with the drift in swearing over time. So blasphemy was considerably more offensive in British English, even 50 years ago, whereas now it tends to be allowed to pass on the national broadcaster, for example. Although one of our much beloved TV presenters apologized for using a B word. Normally, and I'm not sure in the States, but we don't even generally think of swearing these days. It's sort of a very archaic form of blasphemy that most people just wouldn't complain about at all. Whereas there are things that used to be in nursery rhymes or in the titles of books that we now know, you know, even white people know, so he's a racial slur. And that language has fallen out of favor. And that's entirely to do with, as you say, the social constructiveness of swearing, because what does constitute a taboo? And that's something that we have to agree between us as a society. I can't individually decide that I think the word shoes is taboo and insist that it's swearing. It has to be consensus.
And you know, you use these examples of early humans and using language in all sorts of ways and the development of language. And I'm curious about how, if you're developing language kind of at the fundamental and basic level, how that group of humans who are using it as a productive tool to better hunt animals decide that something is taboo. How does that even come about?
I mean, we have certain emotional responses to things that are either can be classified into things like awe or disgust or fear. And those tend to really trigger the taboos. There are some things that set off an emotional response that is so deep and so powerful in us that we start to feel that there's something magical about the words to do with it. And we can see that not just in humans, but also in other forms of primates. So chimpanzees, when you teach them how to use sign language, if you also teach them to be potty trained, which is a really good idea when you're working with chimpanzees, they internalize this excremental taboo to the extent that we know they'll lie about it if they do have a bowel movement outside of the prescribed potty area. Or that they will, you know, put themselves in immense discomfort rather than have a bowel movement in front of another chimpanzee or another human. So they have that privacy taboo around defecation, exactly the same as we do. And that then means that they end up with these great feelings of shame and of the desire for privacy about defecation. But that then means that the word itself, which for chimpanzees is a sign that's usually glossed in English as dirty, That sign then becomes used in exactly the same way as we use our four-letter word for excrement, as an insult or a sign of frustration or a desire to get things done quickly or to express your dismay. So there are some really beautiful descriptions of a chimpanzee, Washo, who would berate Roger Foots, the chap who was studying her, with this sign, dirty, smacking her hand up against the underside of her chin and just sort of basically, dirty Roger, dirty, dirty, whenever he wouldn't let her out to, you know, play in the garden and say, you know, you have to do these experiments instead. And that probably won't come as a surprise to anyone who's ever raised a toddler as well, because you tend to notice that as soon as you start to potty train them and that they know that there's something very special about the act of going to the toilet, there is nothing more hilarious to a four-year-old than or a three-year-old than telling you that you're a poo face at the dinner table. And our response to that, our understanding that a taboo has been transgressed, leads us to either, you know, get them in trouble, as happened when I was growing up, or to laugh, as to my shame I do actually do with my niece. But that teaches them that there's some emotional response in another person to that word. And once you know it has that power, it's very tempting to use it, particularly when you're very young.
This is so funny. Okay, this leads me into a question that I have about placeholders for swear words. So in the case of a toddler, their swearing might be poo face or whatever you said, poo head. but we have, you know, here in Utah, you may know, as the epicenter of the Mormon church. And it's very sweet how they put in these placeholders. They don't want to curse because it's not polite or well-bred or it's just vulgar. So they say lots of things like,
oh my heck.
And friggin' and freakin' and fracking and things like that, and substituting for the F-bomb. And so I'm wondering about those substitutions. Do they work as well? Do they, you know, do they make you feel as good as just dropping the F-bomb?
In general, no. And the reason that people feel able to use those substitutions is that they don't engender this really intense emotional effect. So we see that it doesn't work to kill pain in the same way. And we know that things like heck or fudge or fiddlesticks just don't get the heart rate going, just don't let that adrenaline start flowing the way that the real deal do. But that said, it is so very socially constructed. So I can't speak for the Mormon community in Utah. It may be that those words are considered taboo enough to actually become effective for some people. And it's entirely dependent on what you think of as being important in your particular social group. So a great example is in Canada, where French-speaking Canadians have an entirely different swearing lexicon from either English-speaking Canadians or continental French people. That's all to do with, you know, the Catholic Church and thing, places in the church. So the word tabernacle is right. A forceful swear word, forceful enough to appear in hip-hop music, for example. Whereas to me, that has no resonance at all. So certainly for me, those minced oaths wouldn't give me that pain relief. But if your taboos are such that you start to feel like you're being a bit naughty, or you find yourself getting a little bit sweaty palmed when you say it, then the chances are it will also be good when you need that extra bit of painkilling.
That is so good. And you know, we wanted to mention that the types of swear words are divided into sort of four categories: religious, copulatory, excretory, and slur-based. And I also noticed that when I was in Quebec, yeah, that tabernacle. And then in Spain, Spanish, they say hostia, which is, I think it's the host, again, going back
that's
to
right, yeah,
the Catholic,
the
which
Canadian
I think
way,
is the funniest yeah. thing. I'm going to go around today saying host and
why
see if it does.
Why are people swearing at you across the world? Why are you picking up all these swear words? How do you know these things? It's just amazing to me.
I don't know.
I travel and nobody's swearing tabernacle at me.
You should listen more closely. Maybe you're not listening.
Yeah. And it's funny, again, as a speaker of those languages as the second language, it's amazing how from tone and body language, you can identify which are the swear words very quickly before you have any sense of what they mean, because you see the strength of the emotion in the people around them. They really are a law unto themselves linguistically.
Yes, this is so great. I love this conversation. So let's talk a little bit about how for the last 150 years there has been scientific research on cursing.
That's right. So I think quite a few people in the States may be familiar with the story of Phineas Gage. He was a famous railway worker from the United States who was working to help blast the path through mountains to lay the railroad lines. And he suffered this terrific injury. Be astounding, and his physician was convinced there was no way he could have possibly had this happen to him, because he was tamping down some explosives with about an 8-foot iron bar, and it just passed straight through his head when these explosives blew up accidentally one day. And the thing is that until that point, we didn't really know whether or not the brain was essentially made up of all the same stuff throughout. I mean, we see it had a certain structure to it, but we didn't know whether or not those structures were specialized, because we haven't had any examples where we've been able to see someone lose a part of their brain but continue to live in a way that wasn't, you know, so radically altered that they weren't able to communicate. But Phineas Gage was really different for two reasons. First of all, his was on the scene in about half an hour and actually saw which part lost. He saw Phineas Gage vomit, and the pressure of him vomiting pushed about, his physician describes it as half a teacup full of brain onto the floor. But also Phineas Gage was good enough to let his physician poke around inside. And he described something that we now know of as the frontal lobe of the brain. And Phineas Gage lost this, but nothing else. And it was a remarkably, you know, sort of precise injury as far as injuries go. And one of the things that was noteworthy about his behavior afterwards is that he became incredibly impulsive. And this was demonstrated by the fact that, among other things that he couldn't control, were his bad language. And it was one of the first bits of information that we had that suggested that different parts of the brain did different things. And some of the write-ups of the time seem oddly naive to us now. Someone saying, oh, it's obviously taken away his sense of reverence, for example, and his lack of reverence means that he's now held God's name in vain. But with further experimentation, we know that the frontal lobes are responsible for something called executive function, the ability to, for example, delay gratification or tamp down on those really impulsive behaviors that, you know, make you want to do something that's socially inappropriate. And by Phineas Gage surviving this enormous brain injury, but oddly localized, surprisingly well localized, and his behavior changing in this very specific set of ways that included him becoming a much more vociferous swearer, we got those first hints that it was worth looking at different parts of the brain as essentially different structures on their own.
You know, I always have to wonder where you neuroscientists would be without Phineas Gage. I mean, this guy...
We'd be lost. It was so seminal. And even now, his skull is still being studied. So it's a fantastic piece of work with a 3D reconstruction from his family bequeathed his skull to the physician that had been taking care of him. And it's come down through him to various research institutions. And I can't remember where Phineas Gage's skull is now. But the scans and the reconstruction show that the description at the time by his doctor using an instrument no more sophisticated than his index finger was actually a really good description of exactly which parts of the brain had been damaged, which just all credit to both of them, really.
Now, what's the connection? I mean, Phineas Gage, you mentioned, you know, he became a prolific cusser, but Tourette's, how does Tourette's figure into this? Because I've never really understood Tourette's, but I have a feeling I'm going to have a better understanding after your answer.
Right. I mean, that's another one of the the pathologies that tends to get lumped in with swearing. But actually, it's a bit less likely to cause you to swear than something like dementia or Alzheimer's or even some forms of epilepsy. So from Victorian Britain, there's a neuroscientist by the name of John Hewling Jackson that studied all of these different pathologies. And it's partly as a descent through that set of research that we have an idea of some sort of brain injuries or brain illnesses that, particularly through age, lead you to swearing more. And they fall into essentially two categories. One is this the fact that there are certain parts of your brain that are overly sensitive to. So you see this in obsessive compulsive disorder, you see it in Tourette's, where certain forms of behavior get really reinforced. And others are a bit more like Phineas Gage's injury, in that you lose your ability to suppress behavior that you don't want to carry out. But the thing about Tourette's is that only about 25% of people with Tourette's syndrome end up with coprolalia, the symptom of using bad language. But the problem is that almost every Tourette sufferer starts to suffer with it in sort of mid to late adolescence. And what tends to happen is that their tics are considered to be extremely disruptive by educators, by their peers, by people in social settings. And so one of two things happens to teenagers with Tourette's. Either they tend to be excluded from their schooling or from social gatherings, as though they miss out on this extremely formative stage of their education and of their life. Or else they tend to be medicated to try to prevent the action of this dopamine that's sort of reinforcing the desire to swear or to make disruptive noises. In fact, one sufferer explained how, rather than swearing, he always had the urge to yell the name of his ex-partner while he was being intimate with his current girlfriend. So it is that sense of wanting to yell something that's completely inappropriate. But the social stigma is enormous. And so even though Tourette's tends to attenuate towards the end of adolescence, and in adulthood the symptoms are usually much less severe, people who have gone through the experience of having Tourette syndrome during adolescence tend to do far worse in education, far worse in job outcomes, far worse in making friends and having good mental health. But that's all to do with our response to it. It's all to do with us, you know, having those entirely physiological and entirely instinctive emotional responses when we hear someone swearing. But the problem is that Tourette syndrome is the only disease that I can think of anyway where we medicate the sufferer in order to make everyone else feel more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Because the medications that we tend to give these teenagers to deal with Tourette's also have lots of impacts on their motivation to carry on with their schooling or their motivation to go out and make friends. So either way, these poor kids end up missing out on really important experiences in their life because of our antipathy to their language or to their tickish behaviors. And so the chapter of that book I found sort of very heartbreaking to write, because these kids, they need us to, you know, understand our own emotional response is purely a physical reflex, but that if we try a little harder to understand why they are behaving the way that they are, they wouldn't have to be medicated and they wouldn't feel the stress and pressure of our reaction that tends to lead to more tics in a lot of Tourette sufferers as well. And they would have much better in their education and in their longer life. So just by understanding our own emotional antipathy to swearing and where it comes from, and that actually this is not someone being abusive, this is a sign of a medical issue, I think we can make these kids' lives a lot better.
Right. Our guest is Emma Byrne. The book she has written is called Swearing Is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language. And let's talk about gender differences for a moment, Emma. It's, you know, I was raised with my mother telling me that cursing was not ladylike. What are we seeing here about gender differences with letting the F-bomb drop?
Yeah, those attitudes lie very hard. And even though when you take studies of people speaking naturally, so they're called corpus studies, where you either record people speaking their sort of home environments or in going about their day-to-day business, or where you collect large samples of people speaking and writing, women and men tend to use swearing about the same amount and for more or less the same reasons, although women's swearing tends to be a bit milder. But if you take examples of swearing and randomise whether or not you label them as having been said by a man or by a woman, everyone, regardless of gender, tends to rate swearing as more offensive if it's purported to come from a woman than if it comes from a man. So we have this double standard that isn't actually in line with our behaviour, but it does mean that women tend to get more social pressure about their swearing. They tend to be censured for it. And there's a nice study from the University of Louisiana about 10, 15 years ago of 377 people responded to this study where they'd said how they felt about this swearing if they, you know, they were told that either it came from a woman. You randomize this condition. And they, men and women alike, would say, you know, women are less attractive when they swear, whereas for men there's no effect. Or women seem less effective or less in control when they swear, whereas, again, for men they can seem more commanding and more in control. And one of the reasons for this, sort of studies that have been done over here in the UK, show that it's rated as a what's called a gender transgressive act. So we all do certain things that indicate where you are on the gender spectrum. And so, for example, there are gestures in Europe that are not considered effeminate, but that I think in the United States are. I don't know whether leg crossing is still considered to be quite quite soft in the States, whereas here in Europe you see guys cross their legs a lot. But certainly cursing is definitely one of those things that we say, you know, tells you whether or not someone is masculine or feminine. So women often use it in a way that is instrumental, basically saying, you know, you should listen to me. I am also loud and strong and confident. But there is always a trade-off between the way you're seen as a woman and the way you're seen as an ally or a friend or a fellow fan of this particular team or even a workmate. And so women have to make this kind of trade-off between their identities in order to use swearing, whereas men don't, because it's consistent with how we see men as being. And these attitudes only really sprang into being about 300, 400 years ago with the writing of a treatise here in London by a guy who was the chaplain to the king at the time that was called The Lady's Calling. And in that, he was a chaplain. He was not a doctor, but he asserted that if women swore, that they would start to become more masculine. They would lose all their feminine features and eventually start sprouting big beards and the like. And that's the first time that women are sort of censured for swearing instead of celebrated for their creativity with it. But it's really stuck in every, you know, every culture that has inherited from that British English. That idea that swearing is unfeminine and is unattractive has really stuck to this day.
So funny. Well, we're out of time, Emma, but I just have to relate this, you know, this time when I was young, about 14, and my mother never uttered a swear word. But this on this particular day, she was bending over, and when she stood up into the corner of the kitchen cabinet with her head, and she dropped the F-bomb. And ever since then, every time she curses, I sort of poke fun at her for not being able to do it correctly. Like the time when she stepped up into the cabinet really hurt her head. She almost passed out. But she just said it all wrong. And ever since then, I've thought about, you know, the well-placed word and how you say it and when you say it. And I think it's just fascinating.
Thank you. I mean, it is good for you, but it's good for you in the way that, you know, certain medicines or fiber is good for you. You don't want it to be the entirety of your diet.
Oh, yes. What did
she mustard.
Say? Yeah, the
yeah,
mustard.
Your mustard
yes,
example.
Certainly.
Yes, mustard is good, but don't make a whole meal out of it. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, Emma Byrne, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. The book, again, is Swearing is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you both.
I was trying to weave in a swear word at the end there. I was going to say tabernacle or host, but I just couldn't figure out the right placement.
Well, you know, we didn't ask her how the swear words reflect what's going on in the society.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have to read the book to get that. But, you know, what is considered taboo is directly linked to what's happening in the culture and in the society in that time. And to have some of those words that you've thrown out, host and tabernacle, to be considered swear words is
right.
Very
I mean, those words may not even be permitted on the radio.
By the FCC.
Right. Right. Okay. Don't tell anyone. Oh, boy. Well, that was fun. Let's take a break. We'll hear from our underwriters. And when we return, we'll be speaking with skier Alex Schlope and hearing his very interesting story and what he's doing now. Stay with us.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW's sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
For adventurers on a budget, the Utah Olympic Park offers a host of activities at no charge. Admission and parking are always free. Start with a tour of the Alf Engen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Winter Games Museum. Best of all, come support athletes from all over the world who train at the park. Open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Details available at UtahOlympicLegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
This is Janine Troilo with the Deer Valley Grocery Cafe, and we are pleased to support KPCW. We offer breakfast, lunch, early supper, grocery and picnic items, takeaway entrees, and retail gifts. Wine, beer, and cocktails are available. Open daily in the Deer Valley Plaza building, 615-2400 or deervalley.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. We were just speaking with Emma Byrne, the book Swearing is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language.
Do you remember how excited I was when I saw that book?
I was excited too. And I have to say, I was trying it out a little bit to pepper some colorful language in yesterday. And I have to say, I misplaced a few words. Yeah, I was talking to Jay Hamburger from the Park Record, and I just, off the record, of course, and I just threw one in, just for kicks. It didn't come off well.
How'd it feel, though?
Misplaced. Well, we are now joined in the studio by Alex Schlope, Holly Flanders, and Josh Finbow. And, first of all, you know this name, Schlope. A well-known Park City family. Alex is a highly accomplished free skier who, after winning some of the biggest events in the world during his ski career, which included a world championship title, X Game title, Dew Tour champion titles, well, he took a dive into despair, drug addiction, and ultimately attempted suicide. But hitting the bottom for Alex and then living to talk about it and to bring it out in the open, to be unabashedly honest about it, has helped him, and it is his way of helping others. He, along with Josh Finbow, have started an organization called Rematch, and he's throwing all of his enthusiasm, the same enthusiasm that made him such an accomplished skier, now into helping others and ultimately himself. Holly Flanders, you know her. She is Alex's mother, and we have her on standby in case we want to hear from her. Welcome, all of you, to the Mountain Life, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Well, Alex, we're just going to start with you. It's very bold. It's very brave. It must be scary, or is it? Or are you at just this point where you feel like the more you share, the more you tell your story, the more it's going to positively affect others?
Yeah, I'm not really scared about it because it's something that I'm passionate about. I've seen enough of the downs and the downfalls that come along with drug addiction and depression, where it's time that people speak out about it or be comfortable about it, and we get rid of the stigmas. And that's really what we're hoping to do with our company. We're doing not just a clothing line, but also a nonprofit, which is going to dive more into the science. So I guess at times it's a little scary being this transparent, but it's worth it. So, I'm just happy to be moving forward with it and hopefully helping others push forward with their lives.
You talked about something, first of all, I saw a Facebook post some weeks ago, maybe a month ago, and there was more colorful language, shall we say, mixed in with it. And then now you've kind of refined your story for on your GoFundMe site, talking about Rematch. But one of the things that you say that hits home with, I think, so many people, both kids and parents, especially in Park City, is that you tried so hard to be good and you pushed yourself so hard to be good. And then when in your mind only, you came up short, which was missing the Sochi Olympics by 0.4 of a point, you felt like you had failed everyone. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that actually was the result of setting a bad goal. And I'm a huge advocate of goal setting. And I set a goal where it was kind of my last chance at skiing as far as I saw it. And so I was trying to make the Olympics, or I'd rather be dead. And that's the worst goal I ever set. And how true it became is frightening. And once I missed the Olympics, I kind of didn't feel like there was any more to live for. And it was so wrong, because I'm not defined as just a skier. I'm a human and a person that, you know, we make mistakes. Not everybody can be perfect. And I don't know why I always thought that I had to be something that I wasn't. I mean, you know, it's just, it scares me that I set a goal like that. But now I've learned to change my thinking, and I call it just the positive thinking mind. So I get through day to day now, especially after all the drug addiction, is jumping from positive to positive, not letting anything negative in, because that kind of thing is far too common nowadays, and that runs your mind if you let it. So I like to just think positively, and when a negative comes by, I let it fly by.
And what happened before in your life, Alex, when you were younger? You know, you're talking about now moving positive to positive, but did you exist in a place of darkness when you were young that was self-imposed and self-created, or created by our community, our society, our culture? Or were you a happy kid growing up in Park City and, you know, pursuing skiing and your dreams and setting goals and achieving? Because I'm curious about kind of how you got to where you had created a goal that became counterproductive and destructive.
Yeah, I guess the best way to answer that is I was just very emotional. So I would notice how people were feeling. And if I felt someone was feeling bad or sad, I almost wanted to take on that pain so they didn't have to feel it. So I actually acted like I was really happy for a lot of the time when I was severely depressed. And I think that's something that we've seen a lot of people fall victim to. And you would never guess that, you know, like Robin Williams, for example, you know, he seemed like the funniest guy on earth. Next thing you know, he took his own life. And I can relate to that, as much as I hate to say that. But it's tough, you know. It was hard for me to admit that I wasn't doing well, because I didn't know what would happen. I thought that if I did that, I would lose everything, or I was being too much of a wimp, I guess. I don't know. It seems like in society sometimes men are supposed to be these big, symbols of excellence, and I didn't feel like that at all.
Right. Sensitivity and vulnerability aren't embraced in the masculine the way they are in the feminine. And did you recognize that that difficulty that you were confronting, or were you able to stuff it and compartmentalize it? How did you deal with that as a young kid?
I guess I didn't deal with it, which is the worst way to get about things. The way that what works for me now is dealing with stuff as it comes along and letting it go. The past is the past for a reason. And you don't need to dwell in the past because it's over. And that's how I get by my life today. If I dwelled in the past, I wouldn't be happy at all. And I'm right now broke, happiest I've ever been in my life, living in Park City, working, and just getting by day to day. And that's everything makes me happy about it. Working at a ski shop and just being myself, finally.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question about a concussion that you had that I remember talking to your mother about, because my son also had a concussion, I think, a little bit after you had this really significant one. I remember reading about it as well. Was it part of a competition? And I guess my question is, how much did that play into your depression? Because I know concussion and depression are connected and related.
Yeah, I do think that that was a huge factor. I was 15 years old. There had been a driver from Canada, and I think he was under the influence of something, which is another great reason to not drive under the influence. And he was taking me home from a party, and on the way, he decided to go drift and do donuts in the canyon's parking lot, and we hit a rock, flipped, and where I was sitting, the shotgun seat was crushed to the seat, and I probably shouldn't have survived. And I had a severe concussion after that. I had to drop out of school 3 times, and it took me an extra 2 or 3 years to finish high school because of it. That alone would add depression, but the chemical side of things, I didn't feel right at all. And Josh Fimbo was actually the person who saw me through that time the most, because I went to live with him and his mother for a little bit out in Crested Butte, Colorado, just to kind of brighten my spirits or, you know, anything possible. And he was the one that was there to care for me the most with his mother.
And at the, maybe when you were still recovering from that, you wanted to go back into competition, as I recall. And was that, was that the beginning of the end, or did you come back to your full potential with competition? But as you say, just having set a bad goal, a wrong goal?
Yeah. Let's see. So at that time, at 15, I started training for contest pretty much as fast as I could. You know, within 6 months, I was training for the U.S. Open after the accident. And I fell again and hit my head again and blew out my knee. So I tore my ACL, MCL, meniscus, and got another concussion. So if you want to talk about depression, after that, it was bad. And I could not control it, which I do think that there was some chemical problem going on, because I just couldn't feel happy. I was getting agoraphobia, agoraphobia. I had severe vertigo and anxiety, where the world looked like it was a cartoon. That would start happening out of nowhere and scare me a lot.
That is scary. I think it was after that concussion when I spoke to your mom. And Holly, maybe you could just weigh in here. You know, as mothers, as parents, we feel everything that our children feel, maybe to the nth degree. And I don't know, just take us through, you know, where you are now with Alex and, you know, your hopes for his future.
Yeah, it's amazing being the mom through all this and supporting your child to grow and to, you know, be on their own and to be successful. And everything that Alex has gone through, I wasn't even aware of a lot of this as it was going on. I was watching everything and trying to figure it out, trying to help him and support him, but not be controlling or overbearing. And now I'm just so proud of him for coming through this and moving in such a positive direction. I've never seen anyone more passionate about helping people and trying to bring positivity to the world, to everyone he possibly can. And it just, all of my years of, you know, as a mom, you pray, you do the best you can, you absolutely put everything you possibly can into it. And for it to come out this way is just incredible. It's unbelievable.
You know, Alex, I want to ask you to dive a little deeper on that, because your mom's highlighting something that I think is just amazing, which is where you are today is a phenomenal place. I mean, you're sensitive, you're vulnerable, you have connected with a passion, you are sharing that in a very important way with the broader community. And what you had to do to get to this point, you had to do exactly what you did, and you confronted depression, you confronted death, you confronted drug addiction. That's a horrible journey to go through by anybody's definition. But to get where you are now, how do you look back at that and frame it? I mean, I'm curious what you think of what you went through to get you to this present moment.
That's really tough, and kind of the message I'm trying to spread. And when I look back in my past, it's pretty much quite literally staring death in the face in many aspects. The other option for my drug addiction, having been using heroin and crack, was death. And it's kind of inevitable. It's going to happen at some point if I wasn't able to stop. And that's scary. And, you know, the fact that I had tried to take my own life when I hadn't achieved my goals, that's terrifying. And these are all life lessons that I learned, and something that I didn't read about. I lived it. So now I'm able to catch myself when I'm starting to slip or feel my mind starting to push towards negativity or being overly critical of myself. It's very important to love yourself and remember that, like, you are beautiful no matter what. And there's nobody on earth that doesn't deserve a chance, a second chance, unless you've done something completely horrible, I guess. But that's what we're trying to push, is this is a movement where you allow yourself to kind of shed a layer of skin and, you know, like a snake, I guess, and just keep slithering. And I just can't tell you how much I love life now. And if I wouldn't have made it, just thinking about that always makes me want to cry really a lot, because that was what was going to happen. And
so I'm sure part of your message is that not everybody has to go through the same journey.
Exactly. It's about finding yourself and catching yourself and being okay with it and asking for the help you need before you get to where I was going. And it's all about positivity and reminding yourself that you can rise above and become that great person that you envision. And what I recommend is writing in a notebook what you wish you could be or want to be, and 10 things positive about yourself every day. And just remember that you are a great person. You have great qualities, regardless of what you do and, you know, how you feel, what you think other people think of you. You know, that's nothing.
So let's bring Josh Finbow into the discussion, because Josh, well, good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning.
Thanks for joining. And you've stood by this guy your whole life.
Yes.
And now you are co-founding this organization, Rematch, together. So tell us a little bit what it's about.
Yeah, so I've known Alex for about 12 years now. My background is cinematography, so I started filming him at a young age. I also had my own run-in with alcoholism and addiction. It ripped my life apart for many years. So at this point, now that Alex and I are both out of it and both in treatment, getting better, we decided to come together and create this new company. So there's two different aspects of it. We have the nonprofit, which is going to be all about education and awareness. We're going to use our background with cinematography and create some films, create some videos, get them out there, and try and break down the stigma towards addiction and mental illness.
Well, it seems as though the two of you can go really far. Kids love cinematography. And, you know, I never tell my kids who I'm going to interview, but both of my sons, who are 19 and 23, I texted them this morning. Guess who I'm interviewing? You guys ought to tune in. And so, you know, so you really have this influence. And I think especially going into our schools and in front of our young people, I mean, do you have plans to do this sort of thing with Rematch?
Absolutely. I think we're all going to be speaking publicly about this. And I think just getting our message out is the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. So we're going to, as far as the clothing company goes, I think that's a great way to reach everyone. I mean, everyone's had a bad day at some point in time. So that's going to be a company for everyone. And then specifically just getting the message out about this stigma towards addiction, mental health, it's really important and it's really impacting a lot of America at this point. So, I mean, 1 in 5 adults have some form of mental illness, and Utah is now 4th for drug overdose deaths. So we're really trying to help as much as we can and get this message out. There is hope. It's just a matter of fixing it.
So I saw on your GoFundMe site, and first of all, what's the easiest way to find the GoFundMe site?
Just
enter your name or Rematch?
It's www.gofundme.com/rematchlife.
Okay.
And it's doing great so far. I mean, we're getting the company kicked up off the ground, and I don't think we're going to do well. I know we're going to do well, and I can't wait to help as many people as possible because we have the right team. Everything's falling into line exactly as it should, and I feel great about it. It's helping me in my life a lot, and I can't wait to help impact other lives.
That's great. So just about 60 seconds left, but it's a great sweatshirt that I saw you were holding up or wearing, and it says Rematch. How do you get one of those? I mean, I'm just thinking about the little yellow bracelet that Armstrong put out.
We changed the logo, and we have basically, how quickly do you think we'll get a line out, Josh?
Yeah, we've got the manufacturing at this point, so we're just going to create an order here really soon. If you go to rematchlife.com and put in your email address, we'll send out an email as soon as we have the product in. And it would be a lot of help going to the GoFundMe page and giving us a little extra money to do a bigger order. So
it's been up for about 5 or 6 days now, and I noticed there are like 300 shares, Facebook shares on it. So the story's really getting out. Thank you all so much for coming in today. And Alex, especially for sharing your story, and Josh, yours as well. And thanks, Mom, for coming
in. Thank you, Holly, guys. Holly. You guys rock.
Thank you so much.
For real.
All right. Well, we want to thank our underwriters, Valley Behavioral Health, Jim Doylney and Mark Wingsgard with retail at New Park, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Davidson Orthopedics, Park City Mountain, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and Park Meadows Country Club. And we'll be back after these words.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design. Love your home.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics and KPCW supporter, providing knee and shoulder care focused on cartilage restoration and joint resurfacing. We are now incorporating stem cell therapy and regenerative orthopedics. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You've been listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now to head into National Public Radio News from Washington.